know, Shannon, one of the things I detest at this time of year is an off day for the Toronto Blue Jays. You just get into this rhythm of there being a game every day. And even if you don't watch it, at least, you know, you're kind of, oh, what was the score? You know, in the wintertime, we have lots of off days. Raptors aren't playing. Yeah. Leafs aren't playing, you know.
That's a good point. Yeah, because
it's not uncommon.
Last night was one of those nights where during particularly the last 18 months, where you say, okay, nothing on TV. Well, I'll just turn on the baseball game.
Well,
and I don't know about you, Bob, but I couldn't find the Blue Jays. Now I found Gerrit Cole for the Yankees playing the Angels. I saw my two other home teams, the Los Angeles Angels and the Los Angeles Dodgers.
Yeah, well, there's games if you want to watch them, but for the vast majority, you're going to watch your hometown team.
Sure.
And when the hometown team isn't playing, you go, oh, crap, what am I going
to
do?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. But you knew they have to have an off day for travel from the West Coast.
Oh, no. I get it. I just, you know, it's just an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah.
That you kind of expect during the baseball season. And generally speaking, the baseball season runs at a time when there's virtually nothing else on.
Right.
At that time. So it's not competitive. If there's golf or tennis, those are generally daytime things. Anyway, Blue Jays back in action. We'll talk a little bit about it and what they've gone through, what they can expect. Springer's injury and a few other things with our friend Shai Davidi of Sportsnet when we continue after this. McCowan and Shannon back with you, and our friend Shai Davidi of Sportsnet joins us to chat a little baseball. A couple of series on the West Coast, now back to the East Coast to go to Washington. Didn't used to be that way. Used to go be, if you went to the West Coast, you'd be out there for a while and then you'd come right back home. But I guess there's one of those quirks in the schedule. But they're only playing two in Washington?
Just a pair, sandwiched between a pair of off days. So
yeah.
A weird way to come out of an extended stretch. But, you know, at least this isn't the Washington Nationals of years past. This is the stripped down rebuilding Washington Nationals. So maybe a little bit of a break there, or at least a softer landing.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, this morning I was just thinking about this. Would you rather, if you're the Blue Jays and given their situation, would you rather play presumably weaker opponents like Washington and then they get Detroit? Or would you rather have a whack of games against New York? I guess you're never going to have a whack of games against Oakland or Seattle, but the teams you're up against. I raise that issue only because, Shai, you know, Blue Jays go on a bit of a run during that last homestand and gained negligible ground.
Well, I mean, we could look at it in two ways. One, they do have still a bunch of games against New York and a series against Oakland looming in September, right? So that is coming. But then you factor in that, you know, they're 36 and 39 against teams above 500.
Mm.
And they've done a lot of their damage against, you know, the weaker clubs around the majors. You know, this may be a little bit of a good opportunity to put a couple more games in your back pocket before you get into those critical games. And look, you know, I think right now, as has been the case since essentially early to mid-May, they're still trying to figure out some things in the bullpen. They're hoping to get Tim Mesa back, which will make a big difference. You know, they're, you know, biding time until maybe Nate Pearson is ready or, you know, Ross Stripling gets back so they can shorten up Thomas Hatch. They need to reinforce that bullpen. They need to figure some things out there. And, you know, ideally, you know, you've got a few weeks right now before you're playing those critical games where you can figure some things out and maybe enter those crucial meetings with New York and Oakland in September when you've got a little bit of momentum behind you and, you know, sort of things. So, you know, I think there's a lot of how you want to look at it in the situation right now.
What's the latest on Springer, Shai?
I haven't heard anything as of this morning yet. My guess is that if we're going to see him at all, like we'll see him Friday if he's not going to hit the IL. But look, you know, they've got 45 games left and, you know, this is, I think, day three or day four of a potential backdating an IL stint. You know, do you sacrifice five or six games now to save the 39, 40 games down the road? You know, maybe you do that and, you know, not press, you know, George Springer into action and then maybe make things worse, because, you know, you don't want to obviously lose the timing and the rhythm that he had at the plate, but you also don't want to take him out of the mix for any longer. And, you know, you give him an at bat and he doesn't feel right today in Washington. Well, now it's another 10 days forward. So I think that's going to be a big factor in their calculations, because you've got to really hedge against the majority of games at this point. I think that's where the thought process is going to be.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, the fact that you were able to in the homestand get onto the field and see what this guy does. Do you have a different appreciation of what he brings to this club, both on the field and the intangibles?
I mean, I don't think from on the field, you know, I think that's always been sort of pretty clear. But, you know, just in talking to some people, I actually think what's fascinating, and it's something that I've been wanting to dig into, but, there's just a million polls right now, that, you know, for a guy who just parachuted into a situation with a big contract, you know, it's not always smooth to come in, right? And what he's done, like, I heard a lot of people give him a lot of credit for, you know, making sure that guys stayed focused through the multiple moves, you know, that, you know, it was really a lot was put on the leadership of Ryu, Semien, and Springer, you know, to get guys through and make sure guys stayed focused through, you know, all the upheaval that they've had to endure throughout the course of the season. And the fact that, you know, he had to do it after not playing essentially half a season, you know, that's a tough way to come in. You know, you big contract guy, you know, all the expectations, you're supposed to be a dude, you're doing nothing, and then you're just hanging around the club. You know, that can be a really tricky situation. So the fact that he navigated that so well, built a lot of relationships, you know, I think that really speaks to the caliber of person. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, beyond the on-field exploits that a lot of people around that team are pointing to in terms of the contributions that he's making.
Well, that raises an interesting point, because, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I don't think I've ever seen, and I was going to say a Blue Jay team. I know I have never seen a Blue Jay team. I don't think I've ever seen a baseball team that appears to have more fun when they're sitting in the dugout and rooting for the other guys on their team and the way they react to every hit. And Springer is sort of, I mean, he's in that group of having fun, usually got a smile on his face. I don't know who the leader of that is. I don't know whether that was generated by the kids coming up, Guerrero, Bichette, Biggio, et cetera, or how it evolved. Maybe you know, Shy, but it is a real interesting dynamic that you would think can be very, very important and helpful to this club.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, part of it is, you know, a lot of these guys came up together through the minors. They grew up along the way, right? You know, Vladdy and Bo and Danny Jansen, you know, Lourdes Gurriel Jr., you know, Teoscar Hernandez was a bit ahead of them, but he was in and around that group. You got some of the pitchers, and Manoa was a little bit behind them. Pearson's just a little bit behind them. You know, Baruchy, there's Romano, you know, these guys have known each other and have played and succeeded with one another for a long time. And so you have a little bit of that bond pushing upwards, but then you've added really high quality people into the mix, where, you know, Marcus Semien comes in and, you know, even though he's a more serious guy, you can see him engaging a little bit in some of the hijinks when it's a little bit atypical for his personality, right? And, you know, George Springer was sort of that ringleader type in Houston a little bit. Obviously, you know, Correa was a big part of it there. Altuve was a big part of it there. But, you know, Springer was one of the key parts of that group. And, you know, he brings that to this group here too. And same with Ryu on the pitching side, where, you know, could you, I don't know that you could find maybe two different personality, more different personality types from Ryu to Alek Manoa, but, you know, they've struck it off and have a positive relationship. So, you know, I think you have a lot of guys who are deeply invested in what's happening here. You know, as much as, you know, we talk about Vladimir Guerrero Jr.'s talent and Bo Bichette's talent, like those guys are committed and like they are as determined to win as anybody. Right. And so if you have that and you have, you know, Vladdy's big personality, and that's obviously been magnified this year with the success, it's given him more credibility and cachet in that clubhouse, you know, and then you add those types of guys in, I think you've got a recipe where it can work out really well. And certainly that's been an important dynamic for the Blue Jays this year.
Where does Charlie's personality figure into all of this?
You know, I think Charlie is... You know, I think a lot of people are going to listen to this and throw up their hands because they like they blame Charlie Montoya for every single thing that goes
wrong.
That's
right. That's right.
And, you know,
and by the way, when they win, he doesn't get any credit. So don't worry.
Right. About it. Of course. And look, any manager is only as good as his bullpen, right? You know, I don't care like who you think the greatest manager, like, you know, pick Kevin Cash or Dusty Baker or Davey Martinez or whoever you want, whoever you think is the best manager in the major leagues, right? You give them this bullpen and they aren't doing anything different with it, right? Like maybe you can move the puzzle pieces around, but you're not getting better outcomes because, you know, if you're relying on Travis Bergen and Joel Piamps and Anthony Castro and Leverage to get you to win you games against the Tampa Bay Rays and Boston Red Sox and New York Yankees, it's not going to end well for you most times. So, you know, for me, the key things that Charlie Montoya has done, one, you know when to just get out of the way, which is, you know, a strength that Cito had and didn't get enough credit for. And then, you know, Charlie Montoya also understands he's got a young group and that there are times where, you know, instead of like getting down, you know, you've got to maintain positivity and not put pressure on guys and, you know, let your leadership group lead the way instead of thinking I'm the manager, I have to step in. And, you know, I think in those realms, you know, Charlie Montoya's done really well. And, you know, you think about a team that has had to play in three different home stadiums this year, you know, two of them dreadful minor league parks where things got old real fast for the club. And then, you know, you factor in the bullpen challenges and that the fact that they're still on the verge of contention, you know, I mean, credit to him. And he's not going to get that recognition by and large because people want to dump on somebody, and you know obviously it's convenient to dump on the manager, but you know he's done a lot of taking chicken poop and making chicken salad out of it, and you know he deserves some recognition for that.
Well, I have long been of the opinion and stated so that you can find a bullpen on the street almost anywhere. Relief pitchers are a dime a dozen. You can cobble something together. There's enough of them out there. You should be able to find a couple of half decent ones.
This is disproving that, Bob.
This is absolutely disproving that theory. Because they haven't found anybody who can get people out with any regularity. And I'm really quite shocked by this. And I'm wondering whether there's any chance we'll see anything happen before the end of this month when the interleague deadline, or I guess the internal deadline passes. Is there any hope out there?
I don't know if there's much out there at this point, Bob. Like, you know, Aaron Sanchez just got released by the Giants, and you know, like, is that something, you know, if he still had something left, he wouldn't, you know, the Giants wouldn't have cut ties. There's just not a lot out there. And organizationally, you know, they've gone through what they've got. So, you know, we know who the picks are. It's Thomas Hatch and Nate Pearson. And Pearson threw over the weekend, had a good outing. I'm speculating at this point, I think they're probably going to want to give him two or three more to make sure that he's in the zone consistently and feeling comfortable because he's going to pitch through that sports hernia until the end of the year. You know, and Thomas Hatch, again, this is just my guess, but I don't know that they're going to be comfortable shortening him up until they're sure that Stripling is back and Stripling can be their rotation insurance.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, that's the levers they can pull. I don't know. They could maybe dip into Buffalo, and, you know, Hobie Harris is in the organization, so he'll be fine. But it's a dude who throws 98 and has had some nice moments for the Bisons. You know, maybe that's someone who at some point, you know, gets an opportunity if they move far along down the depth chart. But, you know, the bullpen construction is a super interesting topic to me, because, you know, I think they actually did a lot of the right things this year. And, you know, they, during the offseason, they felt they had a significant enough base of internal talent where they could take a couple chances. So they took a couple high risk, high reward plays in free agency with Kirby Yates and Chatwood and David Phelps. You know, and Yates doesn't make it out of spring training. You know, Phelps doesn't get through the first month of the season, and, you know, Chatwood gets overtaken by his command issues and, you know, can't recover it. And so it, suddenly you're in trouble because you needed one of those guys to hit, and none of them did. And, you know, I think that's where, if you're looking back at this year, where there might be, you know, an opportunity to adjust into next winter.
But I tell you what, if you're talking about Nate Pearson and a sports hernia and waiting till after the season to fix it, I'm not holding much hope up for him on the mound. Are you?
Well, you know, guys have gotten through sports hernias, you know, like I'm trying to remember the season. It was either maybe 11 or 12, but Jose Bautista played a month, the final month plus.
Yeah, but he's not pitching. He's not pitching.
Right. But I mean, you know, you look at the amount of torque that he was putting in his swing and the way that he's twisting and using his core and using his legs and all that, you know, I mean, there was still strain there. You know, I think with Nate Pearson, he's at the point where he's not going to make it worse. Mm-hmm. At least that's what we're being told. And so he just has to learn to sort of work through a delivery where he's comfortable enough through it. And, you know, this is the hope. I mean, this is what they've got right now. So a lot of fingers crossed that it works out for them.
Forgive me, but I thought Merriweather might come back. What's his status? Do you know?
He's continually, you know, every time I ask about him, it's, you know, there's still something there. He's working through it. We don't have a timeline. But, you know, the highway's starting to run out on that one.
Yeah, well, that's the point. Yeah.
And, you know, that to me is the sort of the biggest heartbreaker that the Blue Jays have in the organization, right? Because, you know, you saw it for five innings or whatever it was at the beginning of the season, and you're like, man, this could be magic. But, you know, it's kind of like, is this a desert oasis or is this a desert mirage, right? What are you looking at? Because you just, you know, he's been in the organization since 2018 and, you know, just can't stay on the field. And, yep. You know, he obviously was hurt when he came over and was recovering from the surgery, but to not be able to put together any sort of consistent stretch in the interim and just to continue to have injuries, it's a real loss for the franchise.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back with more. Shai Davidi is with us from Sportsnet, back after these messages. McCown and Shannon and Shai Davidi with us today. Let me get a little something. It's not really off my back, but I'm intrigued because, you know, in a normal scenario, you're with the team on a regular basis and you're on the field every day. And I used to be that one of those guys, but I'm not, and I haven't been for a long time. So this really doesn't impact me, but I find this a curious kind of thing. The Hispanic players on this team seem to have for the most part, have a great reluctance to speak English in public. And I understand that. And when they are gathered at the end of the dugout, we get to hear them yapping. It's almost invariably in Spanish, but every once in a while. So you get the impression that a guy like Guerrero, for example, can't speak English at all and isn't interested in learning to speak English. And then you see him at first base yakking with some guy who doesn't know how to speak Spanish, and, you know, they're talking in English. And sure, it's broken, but I'm not going to be offended by that. He just, for the most part, they just don't want to make the effort.
Or make a mistake.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to be critical. I'm just trying to understand. How do you feel about it?
Well, I'll tell you that Vladdy's English is pretty good, and I've had conversations with him. And I completely understand where those guys are coming from in public, is that, you know, speaking in a second language is in a public setting where your every word gets parsed. I mean, that's really difficult. And, you know, I have a ton of respect for those guys and the challenges that they face of having to come into foreign countries and adapt and not be in their native tongue.
Oh, I do too. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I take no issue with that. And I understand what you're saying, because I think people would love to hear directly from those guys and, you know, that there'd be a connection. But, you know, Edwin Encarnacion, like, he would not do, or was very reluctant and very rarely would do TV in English,
right?
Without an interpreter, because he didn't feel comfortable, and like it made him nervous. But, you know, like I had hundreds of conversations with Eddie over the years, and his English was terrific. But I get that, like, you know, if I had to, for me, I speak Hebrew as one of my second languages, and, you know, like, my Hebrew is okay, but it's not amazing. But if I had to do TV where everything counted, my words in Hebrew, I'd have a tough time with it, and I wouldn't feel really good about it. So, you know, I would always defer to those players and understand that. But there are no issues communicating with their teammates. You know, like Vladdy's English is sneaky good, but I get it. If he doesn't feel that it's good enough to be on a public stage, you know, more power to him. You know, he can speak more comfortably through Hector LeBron, the club's interpreter. You know, he has trust in what Hector says. And, you know, there have been times where, you know, I've been doing an interview with Vladdy, and, you know, he's heard what Hector said, and, you know, he's clarified Hector's interpretation or things like that. So he knows what's up. But, you know, for him at this point, you know, with where he is in his command of English, and I think he feels safer, and it's totally understandable and totally respectable.
Just out of interest, what's Ryu's English like?
It's more rudimentary than Vladdy's, for sure. But, you know, I've heard guys say, like, you know, that he can sneak some stuff in there. But, you know, I think for obvious reasons, you know, it's the transition from English to Spanish, Spanish to English, it's easier than, you know, English to Korean. It's just the languages don't share many words. So
sure.
I think that's been a little bit with Ryu, there's a bit more of a language barrier there. But, you know, the guys seem to be finding ways to overcome.
John, you want to jump in with something?
Well, no, I just, it's funny. I think we see this now in every sport. I think we see players that are more comfortable in their own language and slowly migrate to English. We certainly see it in hockey now with the Swedes and the Finns. It takes time. I mean, I remember for years, Jaromir Jagr refused to do interviews. And here, one of the greatest stars of the game of hockey. And it took him, I think, you know, a decade to feel comfortable enough to do interviews in English. And that he wasn't doing very many of them. He would just decline doing interviews at all because most NHL teams weren't carrying along a Czech interpreter for him. So that it's one of those things in baseball. I over the years, I think it's just a fact of doing business. Don't you, Shai?
Yeah. And you know what, you know, baseball, and, you know, I'm reluctant to give them too much credit because, you know, literally took decades and, you know, teams being shamed into hiring interpreters because, you know, the Japanese and Korean players that came over got their own personal interpreter. Meanwhile, you have, you know, 30 to 40% of the league that is ESL, and you can bother to hire an interpreter for them for decades. But, you know, to their credit, or, you know, belated credit, you know, they were like, okay, we got to take care of this. You know, and every team has an interpreter, that's his job. And, you know, certain clubs, you know, give that person other duties. You know, Hector LeBron helps out with the infield and things of that nature. You know, their previous interpreter, Josue Pele, used to do some catching in the bullpen and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. But you had somebody who was dedicated to that role and ensuring that your players don't end up in a bad position. And, you know, I think that's, to be honest, it should be standard issue for anybody who's going into a country where, you know, they don't have the language, but they have the skills. You know, they shouldn't be punished for that. And, you know, I think you've got to take care of your population. And you look at the population in the major leagues, you know, with the number of players from Latin America, you know, the fact that, you know, this is a relatively recent phenomenon, considering how long they've been such a significant part of the game for, you know, in a lot of ways is kind of absurd, but, you know, here we are.
Just curious. I'm not on many or any of the Zoom calls for media. The ease of doing Zoom calls, are there any Latin reporters following the club, and do they do interviews in Spanish?
Not as consistently in the years past. Ryu definitely has a consistent following. And, you know, there's a crew of South Korean media that is there every time he's pitching and are inquiring about him. But, you know, occasionally there'll be some Latin media that pops in and out. They want to do something on, you know, Vladdy or Teoscar or whoever it may be. Marley Rivera from ESPN, you know, she's bilingual, and, you know, she'll pop on periodically to do some stuff for ESPN Deportes with some of those guys. But there's no one who's on a consistent basis right now. Okay.
I'm going to change gears just slightly, stick with baseball. Joey Votto got his 2000th hit the other night. Only the second Canadian player ever to achieve that plateau. He's truly a very good player. I'm hesitant to say great player because everybody has where their bar is. And I'm not sure whether Joey goes over the bar for,
doesn't help. He's playing everybody in Cincinnati though.
Well, and that's part of the point, is he's played with an organization that has been frugal and has not had great success. But Joey Votto has hung up numbers consistently. When all is said and done, where will Joey Votto rank in terms of the Canadian players who have played this game?
I'm reluctant to say this because of my admiration for Larry Walker, but he may very well end up being the best ever. I mean, certainly the most complete hitter. And Larry Walker was pretty complete too. But I mean, you're talking about a guy who right now has a 417 career OBP, an absolute hitting savant, somebody who has such phenomenal bat control that you can count, you know, infield pop-ups over the course of his career on your fingers. The amount of things that he's done that are just so beyond the average hitter, you know, he's just, there are a lot of things that, you know, he's doing that Larry simply doesn't, right? Or didn't. And, you know, he's going to be one of the best hitters of this generation, of the 2000s, certainly. And, you know, I think there's a pretty good case for him in the Hall of Fame, you know, even if he stopped right now, because it's a pretty remarkable peak. It's a pretty incredible peak with a lot of the things that he's done. And, you know, I think that there's going to be a case that, you know, he's going to have surpassed Larry Walker. You know, he's been a good defender at first base. You know, he's got a gold glove, but, you know, obviously it's not the defensive impact that Larry Walker had. And he was never the base runner that Larry Walker was. But from a offensive hitting perspective, you know, the OBP, the bat control, the average, the power, the slug, you know, it's a more complete version of Larry Walker. And, you know, I think that there's going to be a pretty good case that he's the best Canadian ever.
But doesn't it really, again, it's a difference between an individual honor in a team sport. Is it just Cincinnati's success rate has just been so minimal? Doesn't that affect everything?
I don't think it should. I think if you're looking at it through that lens, then, you know, as a guy who's often been an island in that lineup, you can make the case that it's even more impressive what he's done, because, you know, teams had no reason to pitch to him a lot of the time. And because he's the guy that you can't let beat you, and he still found ways to beat you. And, you know, there was a point in time in Cincinnati where he got some criticism because of how he would take walks or situations where, you know, maybe you needed to try to get the bat to the ball and create some things to happen. But he thinks the game at a level that's beyond everybody, right? Like, he would look at situations and understand what is the best probability for team success. You know, that what could he do that would put his team in the best position, and he would use that to dictate his approach to at bats. You know, he would think about you know, the different leverage points at each pitch and count, and how that would impact his attack tactics. You know, I mean, he's such a unicorn in so many ways. I don't know. I get the, you know, we like to lionize people who have had postseason success, and it's easy. But to me, it's harder to sometimes be that guy on a bad team. And he's been that guy consistently, regardless of the situation. And to me, in a lot of ways, that's even more admirable.
He's kind of the Ernie Banks of this generation, isn't he, in many ways?
Yeah, it's a sad comparison, but it's not a bad one.
Yeah. And how do you, this is one I always have trouble with. We haven't mentioned Fergie Jenkins in this conversation, although this was very impromptu. Fergie Jenkins was a great player, but he was a pitcher. And we're talking about Walker and Votto as everyday players. And that's sort of, to me, it's sort of like apples and oranges. I don't know how to compare the two. Do you?
Yeah, I'm the same way. I look at them as sort of in, you know, they're different creatures. And also, you know, there's a bigger gap between eras there too. But, right. You know, I mean, some of the stuff that Fergie Jenkins did, right? Like, we're just not going to see pitchers do that again.
Oh, no.
You know, right? Like, of course, you know, not. I mean, I'm just looking this up right now, but he had 5 consecutive innings of 5 consecutive seasons of 300 innings plus.
Yep.
Right? Like, that's, you won't see guys have 5 years of 200 innings plus anymore. So, you know, he's definitely a product of a different era. And I think you make the case that, you know, certainly if you're looking all time, you know, from a war standpoint, you know, Fergie's definitely number one. And, you know, there's a clear gap between him and Walker. It's about, you know, 12 wins between the two. And there's, you know, a further 12 win gap between Walker and Votto. But again, you know, we're comparing across eras, we're comparing across games. And, you know, you think about the success that Joey Votto's having or has had during this sort of pitching renaissance we've seen over the past, you know, half decade, where, you know, velocity's been up, strikeouts been up, to continue to put up numbers as pitching's gotten so elite. You know, I think that's all the more impressive as well.
Hey, did you watch the Field of Dreams on Thursday?
I caught a little bit of it. I gotta be honest, I couldn't fully buy into the recreation of simulated sentimentality for Major League Baseball profit. You know, there was a part of me that thinks, you know, when, you know, minor leaguers are, you know, sleeping 5 to a room and being paid these poor wages, and, you know, you can pour $5 million into a showpiece game on the field, there's an element to that's kind of gross. But look, it was pretty, it was picturesque. And, you know, the notion of it is kind of cool. But, you know, I think if you're going to go down that road, I would rather see you, you know, rebuild the outfield walls at old style parks and, you know, play a game like that to recreate, say, the Polo Grounds or Ebbets Field, or, you know, bring a game back in time like that. You know, to me, that's bringing some real history, as opposed to being, hey, this movie made me feel nice, let's try to pretend that we're going to make this movie into a reality.
Well, I share your sentiment, to be honest. I know it's not particularly popular. And it smacks to me already after one. And this is not, there's going to be more of these.
Yeah,
for sure. You know that there will be more of these. And this smacks to me of the first outdoor game in the NHL that we saw. And the whole concept of, oh, people like this, and we can make a boatload of money and put a ton of people in the seats. And now an outdoor game in the NHL isn't an event anymore.
Right.
It's long past being an event. It's a cash grab and that's it, period. And I get that. Okay, it's professional sports. I mean, I got people texting me, like the day after the Field of Dreams game, wouldn't it be great to have the Blue Jays play the Detroit Tigers in the Labatt Park in London, Ontario?
I got those too.
You did too? I mean, what's the comparable relevance of that?
Right. You know? I think over 162 games, the notion of having, you know, a one-off that's great and a little bit different, I can see the attraction to it, right?
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, and I think, you know, the outdoor game in the NHL, it's like, it's definitely gotten old and maybe it's a bit oversaturated, but the idea of sort of moving it to a different location periodically, you know, I think and bringing it to different sites, I think there's something that's still kind of cool to it because it's different and it's fun. And, you know, for especially us in the Northern climes, you know, it's there's a nostalgia to it, and it's a genuine nostalgia because, you know, we all played, you know, outdoor hockey at some point, whereas, you know, we didn't all try to recreate Field of Dreams and play in a cornfield because, you know, Kevin Costner went there and said, have a catch to his mythical dad, right? Like, that to me is like, you know, that where you're creating real, you're treading off something that was real and genuine and authentic in the outdoor game, where, you know, the Field of Dreams is just, it's to me, it's forced. And I'm trying, and I really tried not to be too cynical about it, but I just couldn't help myself. And I don't know, I think, again, like, do something where there was actually something real, recreate Polo Grounds, recreate Ebbets Field or Crosley or any of the great classic parks from history. And then you're tying the game, you're tying today's game to the history of the past. Like, that to me would be cool. And that would be something that's real. But, you know, I mean, I'm sure there's some sort of corporate tie-in with the Field of Dreams and, you know, the production company and Major League Baseball that says, hey, let's see if we can make this happen and turn this into something a bit more. And like, I get it to a certain degree, but also, it's just not real. There's no authenticity to it, at least to me.
Interesting thing is that when I was going to ask you the question, it felt like it happened forever ago already, and it's only 5 days. And that was the part that I was, have we talked about this with Shai since the last time he was on? It was only last Thursday. And that, you know, there are so many things in a baseball season, in any professional season, that it's fleeting. Now, if I'm Major League Baseball and I'm Fox, perhaps I've attracted 7 more viewers to baseball the rest of the way. And I think that's part of it. I thought it was cool. In the end, the 9th inning made the game. When you think of the Yankees scoring the 2 big home runs and then Anderson doing what he did in the bottom of the 9th. But, you know, that's the part that in the end, I was more excited about the baseball game than I was the setting.
Yeah, and it could have been anywhere.
That's right. Yeah, for sure. That's right.
You know,
it's funny. I have a friend who's super cynical, who works in the game, and he texted me about it. He's like, "Hey, what did you think of it?" And I said, "I'm trying not to be too cynical about it," but he goes, "I agree with everything you said, but the home runs into the cornfields were cool."
Yeah, that's right.
So yeah. I think like it aesthetically it was cool. There's no doubt. But you know, the game absolutely made it.
Hey, you didn't travel with the club west, so does that mean you got to watch some AL East baseball earlier? And any scouting on what the Yankees, Tampa, and Boston have to do, and what the Jays are up against?
Well, I mean the Yankees are, you know, full cylinders right now, right? Yeah. They went on a run at the same time that the Jays have. So that was, you know, from a Blue Jays perspective, not ideal. But look, you know, they made some moves and, you know, they really paid off for them. And, you know,
Garrett Cole's off the COVID list.
Off the COVID list and came back with a solid outing and, you know, was thrown, his second pitch or third pitch back was 100. So, you know, no long COVID there or anything like that. You know, I think the Yankees are going to be a problem because they addressed some of their issues and they just became a really fearsome lineup. You know, Boston, it's, you know, Chris Sale's in the mix now. So that's certainly a boost. They just picked up Travis Shaw, which is going to be interesting to see how they use him. You know, Schwarber is still on the mend there. But you still look at Boston, you're like, how are they doing it? But, you know, they've done it to this point. They're probably not going to disappear. Sort of like the Giants, you know, those are the two teams you're like, you know, how are these guys doing it? But they just keep doing it. You know, the Rays are, you know, in control of their own fate. And, you know, they're, you know, just probably the most complete team in the division, you know, over the 26 man roster. So, you know, it's going to be a tough road, but, you know, the Blue Jays do have some games left with Baltimore, and that's going to be an advantage, you know, as long as they do their part. But I don't know, it's a really compelling division. I mean, the American League East and National League West are just, you know, total toss-ups and really fascinating races. And sort of it's a lot less interesting everywhere else in the majors.
You're always generous with your time. We thank you for it. And we'll have you back before the season is over again, we hope. And stay healthy and happy, okay?
Same to you guys. It's a pleasure as always.
Shai Davidi of Sportsnet, back after these messages. Again, our thanks to Shai Davidi for being with us.
Cynical bugger. Cynical guy.
Well,
you know, but
look, I believe that Major League Baseball will try and have another Field of Dreams game. But I hope they don't. And my hope is that what they come to realize is that only works when you can have Kevin Costner out on the field, when you can bring the players in through the corn. After that, it's just a baseball game in Iowa.
Oh, they got 28 other teams they can do it with.
Well, they can. I just hope they realize that you did it. It was fine.
Mm-hmm.
Move on.
Yeah.
Stop.
You know,
I've been saying that about the NHL and outdoor games. The one thing I recognize is the NHL with outdoor games generally has anywhere from 30 to 100,000 people that they can attract for this because they're outdoors and in football or baseball stadia for the most part. And so there's a rev gen there.
Well, see, the one thing I would say is the closest thing, if you wanted to do an outdoor game in hockey like that, like is play it on the glacier at Lake Louise. But then there's nobody there to watch it.
No.
And there's no revenue generation. And that's just not going to happen. I mean, I look at what they tried to do a similar thing in Lake Tahoe this last hockey season. And I don't think it'll be viewed as much of a success after the fact.
Where was the first hockey game played?
Outdoor?
Well, any game.
Well, the first
game was an outdoor game, I'm sure.
Yeah, but the first in the NHL, the first game was played.
No, not the NHL.
Oh,
I'm talking ever.
Ever?
Was it McGill University?
There's people that say it was in Montreal. There's people saying it was Kingston, and there's people saying it's in Windsor, Nova Scotia. So there's even a fight over that.
I mean, if you're going to play an outdoor game again, maybe tie some historical reference into it, or maybe there's so much controversy over where the first game was played.
There is. There's tons.
Well, I know that maybe they don't want to choose one.
Yeah. So they go and say the first NHL game was in Montreal.
Yeah, but that was indoor, and
yeah,
you know.
Oh my God, indoor hockey! What do they think of next?
It'll never last. That'll do it for us. Have a good day, everybody, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.